My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me all the way from WETA are Christopher O'Reilly and Matt Heimovitz. You might recognize Christopher O'Reilly from the NPR show From the Top, of which he's been the host for about 15 years. He's a pianist. He attended the New England Conservatory of Music. And like Classical Classroom, Christopher is all about bringing classical music to new audiences. In fact, in addition to his more traditional classical music recordings, he's made some very cool collections of songs by Radiohead, Nick Drake, Nirvana, and others that are arranged for piano. Matt Heimovitz is a cellist. He attended Juilliard and Harvard. Never heard of either of those schools. he was the youngest person to receive the Avery Fisher Career Grant for Exceptional Musical Achievement. He likes to bring classical music to non-traditional venues like nightclubs. In fact, he was the first classical artist to record at CBGB's, the famous New York club. He started the Oxingale record label, on which you can find Chris and Matt's brand new CD called Beethoven Period. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Daisha.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, playing the Beethoven sonatas on original instruments.
And sorry, this is Chris, right? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I can't see either of you, so just making sure.
We've been playing together now for 4 or 5 years, and we're always slaves to our passions and discoveries. So we were invited to play at the Beethoven International Festival in Chicago, and the thought was, if they had an instrument available, we wanted to maybe perform them on the instruments of Beethoven's time.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, and Matt can speak to this directly, but he will absolutely admit to really hating playing with piano, more or less.
I think it's a terrible combination.
Yeah.
Cello and piano, they don't belong in the same room, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, he's been pitted against, you know, muscular Russian pianists. I mean, I had to beg him to play the Rachmaninoff Sonata with me, because the last time he played it, you know, he was playing with a pianist, you know, with whom he could not be heard.
No names will be mentioned.
No names, but muscular Russian, I think, we'll just pass with
muscular
that.
Muscular Russian.
Yeah, so so the idea behind...
It wasn't Putin.
No, it wasn't. we got to play on a forte piano. We call our modern instrument a piano forte, and that's basically how it was. But the forte piano was the early version of the piano, and there were instruments in Beethoven's time and Mozart's time that the hammer strikes the strings, as opposed to a harpsichord where the strings are basically plucked by the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
The forte piano is not as loud as the contemporary piano. And so in playing with the forte piano, I was the one who had to be worried about being drowned out. Matt had suddenly all kinds of room to not only be heard, but to be expressive and mm-hmm. to really be weaving in and out of the texture in terms of prominence or retiring.
That's the point that changes everything, really, is when I have to put things in relief so that you can hear things happening in the piano part, that's an experience that I just simply didn't have before working with the forte piano.
I liken it to the scene in Titanic when Leonardo DiCaprio is handcuffed by the evil ship's steward, and the water is rising, and he barely has enough room to breathe. And that's oftentimes, I think, where this dastardly partnership between piano and cello falls flat, because he usually barely has enough room, headroom, to really just be heard.
Mm-hmm.
So Matt had found a cello of Beethoven's time on which he could replace the steel strings with gut strings. Well, Matt, you take over. You can tell her all about this.
Right. So I got a hold of this cello, actually at an auction, and just made a very impulse purchase. It looked great. I didn't even have a chance to try it, but I outfitted it with the gut strings, with these ox gut strings from Italy.
Well, let's get really basic and explain exactly what gut strings are, because we're talking, and first, and actually before we even go there, what period is this from? Like, when did the forte piano exist? When were people playing on gut strings?
We're talking about, for our sake, late 18th century and beginning of early 19th century.
Okay.
It was incredible how fast the technology was developing then. So within the span of one or two decades, the forte piano / piano was evolving at a very rapid pace. It was getting louder and louder very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, loudness isn't everything. I mean, it's just, to some degree, we lost, there's a sense of humanity to these instruments. Like I mean, in Chris's case, when he was playing the Broadwood forte piano, that he had a soft pedal. He had a unicorda pedal that was so magical, and I was incredibly jealous of this effect. I wanted to take out all my guitar pedals and, you know, have something to compete with that kind of color. It was just incredible what he was achieving with that. And that also was a revelation for the Beethoven sonatas, because all of a sudden, when you have something incredibly quiet, you have pianissimo marked, and Beethoven was a man of extremes. He wrote extreme dynamic markings, telling us to play soft and softer, you know, and I mean, he kept pushing it. And then you understand, when you have an instrument like that can achieve that, what he was after.
Basically, to give you the background, I mean, when you look at the inside of a piano, a modern piano, most of the keys have three strings for each note that you play on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Matt refers to the una corda pedal, that means one chord, one string. And even on a modern piano, the soft pedal, the left pedal on the piano, the break, as it were, shifts the whole keyboard over so that the hammer is no longer striking three strings, but it's actually striking two. So you get a little bit more of a plangent sound, and it certainly is less loud, to say the least. On the Broadwood, the 1823 original Broadwood that we recorded and performed on, this instrument has the capability of actually shifting the keyboard over so that you really are playing on one string per note. And it gives it this sort of guitar-like quality.
Very delicate.
Very delicate. And so it's a very different color.
Okay, well, that kind of answered a big question that I had, because, you know, often when I hear music that's played on period instruments, I'm always like, there's this part of me that's kind of going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
We've got plenty of great modern instruments to play.
Right.
I feel like, I sometimes feel like these recordings are kind of like the classical music equivalent of, you know, like an indie band recording on a four track despite the existence.
Lo-fi.
Laptops,
well,
and Pro Tools.
It's lo-fi.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, people are putting out vinyl now more than, you know, more than CDs.
Yeah.
So there's a certain nostalgia for it. But also, I mean, in a way, I think of these early instruments I mean, that was the technological equivalent of the iPhone and the iPad and the, you know, I mean, these were the cutting edge technologies. And it's amazing to me that over hundreds of years, the cello hasn't changed that much.
Well, I was just going to say, like, in this situation, it seems like these particular period instruments really make sense for this combination of instruments. I mean, like, clearly Beethoven's markings and just the sheer volume of the piano in this combination, like, it just makes sense.
Well, we're also dealing with, in Beethoven's time, you were playing in smaller rooms. Mm-hmm. It was, in fact, a more intimate sound. There wasn't necessarily the desire or need to project to the back of a 2,000-seat hall.
Right. And
in a modern situation, you're still dealing with a very intimate, in the case of this recording, you're dealing with an intimate listening situation. Mm-hmm. The microphones are very close to these instruments. And so there's no need, again, to, you know, swing for the back rows of the hall. What you're getting is an immediacy and an intimacy of sound and a much more palpable sense of the great range of color, which is, you know, not necessarily all about projecting, you know, mm-hmm. the sound. It's all about making a malleable and infinitely colorful sound, mm-hmm. to the point where, you know, I think a general rule of thumb as far as modern pianos and forte pianos are concerned, we revel in the booming sound of the Steinway bass register,
yeah,
and the beautiful ever singing sound of the upper register that just rings forever. On the forte piano, the bass is not so much booming as more penetrative. It's almost like a bassoon type sound.
Hmm.
So again, you're not making a welling up kind of sound that's going to bury the sound of the cello. You're really just making a more punchy and a much more transparent and penetrating sound.
Mm-hmm.
And the right hand, the upper register of the piano, is again still very singing by comparison to the bass. But again, in a much more fragile sort of way.
What happens is the sense of rhetoric, the sense of speech that you get in the phrase becomes much more defined and much more natural for us to produce. We, of course, we can learn from this and adapt it to whatever tools we have, to the modern setup. But with the original instruments, that's organic to the language.
Yeah. Now, the gut strings, I feel like we got sidetracked a little bit. Were these actually made of guts originally? And what are they made of? What are they made of now?
You're about to lose your animal rights audience. I'm really sorry. I'm going to tell you about the slaughterhouse. This is where it begins.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, since I've become really interested in...
These are free-range gut strings, though. So tell her about that.
Good,
so that's
good.
Yeah.
They're responsibly
And they come with a dozen
sourced.
Eggs with every
okay.
purchase, actually. Yeah.
Cool.
It's not cat gut, I'll tell
yeah,
you that.
Because that would never have washed
dog,
with me.
Dog gut.
Yeah,
no. Now, you can get a range of gut strings. Now, the reason I use these strings from the Taro brothers in Italy, well, I love the sound of them, and they apparently live right next to a slaughterhouse. And so the gut, you can get ox gut, you can get ram gut, all kinds of different gut. I happen to like the ox gut for my cello. And so the string goes straight from the slaughterhouse to the workshop mm-hmm. of these brothers their family has been making these strings for hundreds of years. And so it's the same process that they've always used.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining them with a nice bottle of Chianti or two. And the strings are not always perfect, but they sound great. And it's because there are no preservatives used. You know, it's just
really?
it's a very quick process straight from the slaughterhouse to their workshop.
So this is literally what you're playing on. It's like, I mean,
this is what I'm playing on. And I, you know, I've had to change all my fingerings. The pure gut string just feels great under the finger.
Hmm.
So I want to spend more time on it, which means that I want to do more on one string instead of crossing over, which, you know, you often want to do for safety, or, you know, you want to avoid shifting as much as possible.
Yeah.
In this case, with the gut strings, it's so wonderful to shift, and you can get such a variety. So you really can emulate the human voice. You can really do all kinds of portamenti, and literally there's so much more color.
portamenti. Can you define that for me?
It's basically sliding around.
Oh, gotcha.
Sliding
from one note to another.
Yeah, it's sliding around from one note to another.
Okay.
When you do that with a human voice, it's natural.
Yeah. As opposed to da-dee.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of sounded like Frank Sinatra.
Oh, thank you, Matt.
Sing for us more, Christopher. So do these eventually, because there are no preservatives, do they just sort of degrade underneath your, you know,
there must be some sort of preservative process in making the strings, right?
I don't know the whole process of how, I've wanted to go visit them, not to see the animals slaughtered or anything, but just to see how they make the strings. And I don't really know the process. What I can tell you, in the lower strings, the gut, I use gut that's wound with silver. Uh-huh. And that does come unwound. In fact, as we were, Chris and I were touring in the Northwest through Seattle, mm-hmm. Portland, Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, it started to unravel to the point where I just started posting pictures of this gruesome scene of the string.
the desiccation of the strings.
It was just, I wasn't quite sure. And I thought, well, this is going to get bloody because, you know, it's like... It's getting unsafe, but fortunately my calluses have been built up to the point where it was all right.
Was Beethoven the kind of guy who would care whether or not his music was recorded on these specific instruments that he had written for, or would he not have cared?
Well, my teacher Russell Sherman always described Beethoven as a composer who is always asking for 20% more from the performer, 20% more than can be achieved. Mm-hmm. And this has to do with any, you know, modern or original instruments sort of setup. In other words, he's asking for 20% more technique than anyone can possibly provide. Mm-hmm. He's asking for 20% more sound than can be provided. I think this had a great deal to do with, you know, the fact that he was hearing, you know, less and less as he became older and lost his hearing. But he was, during his lifetime, very much dissatisfied with the stability of the instruments. He was constantly breaking piano strings when he was performing and was always looking for more sound, regardless, you know, his hearing loss aside. Mm-hmm. So I think he would have been very pleased with this particular instrument that we played on, because it has a fair amount of sound to it. Mm-hmm. And I think he probably would have enjoyed aspects of the modern cello and piano setup for the sheer volume of sound, but I'm pretty sure he would have rankled at the lack of revolutionary and visceral quality to the sound that I think is only available on the original instruments.
You know, with the Opus 69 Sonata, the sort of the central sonata of the five of Beethoven, mm-hmm. he's tortured about how to create a sense of equality and balance between these two very disparate instruments. And you can see it in his handwriting. You can look at the manuscript, a beautiful manuscript has survived with Beethoven's own hand, where as the piece progresses, he starts pressing more and more on the sheet of paper, and he starts crossing things out, and he starts shifting things from the left hand of the piano to the cello and back from the cello to the right hand, and he's really tortured about how to make this combination work. And
because after all, you know, Opus 5, the two Opus 5 sonatas were really cello sonata 1.0. These were the first pieces ever written that, you know, the cello and piano were supposedly on an even playing field.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Was this like
Mozart,
a common
Mozart
combination?
Didn't do it. No, Mozart didn't do it. Haydn didn't do it. Boccherini, you know, made cello show pieces, but those were basically for keyboard accompaniment. The keyboard was in the background. So Beethoven was really
there was nothing like nothing like Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And he in that sense he was an opportunist. He saw his opening.
You know, was this sort of like he was challenging himself? I mean, I know that the way you guys are describing it, the forte piano and the cello with the gut strings were more. They're more complementary instruments than the modern versions of them. But because this wasn't done, like, I wonder if he was setting up a challenge for himself to, like, work within these sort of
difficult
parameters.
Well, I think he was challenged and inspired. There were actual cellists of the time.
He was a young man with a dream, you know? I mean, it hadn't been done. So he was making his way. Nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
And he in fact, that was his first big trip outside of Vienna. He had just moved to Vienna and started, you know, traveling around. Went to Prague and then ended up in Berlin at the court with King of Prussia, who happened to be an amateur cellist. Mm-hmm. And the King of Prussia surrounded himself with the greatest cellists of the day. Chris mentioned Boccherini. Then there was the Duport brothers, Jean, and especially Jean-Louis Duport, who must have been a spectacular cellist. And Beethoven was very inspired. And so he wrote the early two sonatas and two sets of variations for them to play for the king, and that's how it all started. So fortunately, there was sort of cello in the air in Berlin in 1796, and that's what led to it. But then I think Beethoven really became fascinated with this combination over the course of his career, and he returned to it in two further just very important periods in his life. One, you know, the Opus 69, where he took a break from the Fifth Symphony. You know, so mm-hmm. imagine that Beethoven's writing his opus, big opus, right?
Right.
The Fifth Symphony. And just takes a little break as he's writing that to just, you know, jot down a little Opus 69 sonata for cello and piano. And
a little me time.
Yeah, procrastinating.
Which has not been surpassed in history, basically. Wow. You know? I mean, it's just the great, you know, cello sonata. And then later in his life, he started to have personal issues and creative issues. This is after the Immortal Beloved letter, mm-hmm. which some folks might have heard of. And so he sort of has given up on the hope that he's going to find his soulmate and that he will ever...
or any personal fulfillment as opposed to artistic fulfillment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's writing some things just, you know, for some cash some things that aren't such great quality. And he's revising a lot. And he's working a lot on his opera, Fidelio. And then looking back at the music of J.S. Bach and Handel, two of his favorite composers, mm-hmm. and inspired by that sense of counterpoint you know, some of the fugal writing there, he emerges with the late two sonatas for cello and piano. And that's sort of the window into his late style, into the very personal style, which for years, and still to this day, many audiences, you know, it's kind of out of reach. It's unintelligible to them because he's gone so far from the sort of what we expect of the Enlightenment.
It sounds like maybe like a problem, like a puzzle that he sort of kept coming back to.
Like
over
the glass
time.
Bead game of Hermann Hesse. You know,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I feel like we've talked more about what it's like for musicians to play on these instruments, which is a huge, you know, a huge part of this. But how is this experience different for listeners when they're hearing these pieces, you know, on modern instruments as opposed to period instruments?
Well, it's really, again, a matter of drawing the listener in to the situation instead of playing at them. So, for instance, we reunited with the instrument we recorded on. We just played at the San Francisco Conservatory on this same 1823 Broadwood on which we recorded at Skywalker Ranch. I mean, what a wonderful anachronistic juxtaposition there. You know, you're a quarter mile down the hill from the house that houses the first lightsabers, and here you are playing on a 200-year-old instrument. But another great anachronism was we actually had a fortepiano copy brought to the Tractor Tavern, a club that Matt had played at a number of years ago in Seattle. And we had a Cracker Jack sound guy, and so despite the, you know, the small size of that piano, we were able to get the sound into all the nooks and crannies, and had Matt amplified as well, because, you know, clubs, you know, you really need some help to get all the sound to really fill the room. It doesn't have to be enormously loud, but you have to have some well-placed speakers. And so we were able to get the best of both worlds. We could both be heard, but we could draw the audience into the intimate sound of this. And the audience, I've never heard a more rapt silence from an audience as I did in that 250-seat club. It was just amazing. And so, you know,
the except for that heckler.
Yeah. No way.
Matt, well, because for the San Francisco program, we were going to do the early two sonatas and the late two sonatas, because I agree with Matt, the Opus 69 is a perfect culmination of his strivings for making an even sound between the piano and the cello, such that it actually sounds pretty good on modern instruments, and doesn't sound quite as radical as the massive qualities of the Opus 5s and the pristine counterpoint and interplay of voices, the transparency of the Opus 102 sonatas. Mm-hmm. So we were going to leave that off the program as we did in San Francisco. And Matt says, you know what? I know this audience. They're going to demand the Opus 69 because we're already dealing with a two-hour program. Yeah. And sure enough, Matt is, you know, talking about, well, we're going to do the Opus 5s. And then after intermission, we're going to do the Opus 102s. We're going to skip the Opus 69. I want my Opus 69. I'm not leaving without Opus 69. Sure enough, we had to play the 69 for our 25-minute encore at this date.
It was
quite gratifying. It was
play
kind of exhausting.
Play Freebird, man.
Yeah, exactly. It was Beethoven's version of Freebird, yeah.
That's awesome. I was kind of thinking about this too. You know, you're talking about playing this music in a club, so it kind of answers a question that I had. But I know you guys are both, you know, interested in bringing classical music to new audiences. And Christopher, you've arranged Radiohead and Arcade Fire and all of that, like, kind of crossing those lines in a really cool way. And Matt, you've played at CBGB's, which is, man, that's really cool. And like, I was really interested that you guys were going back to period instruments and wondering about that sort of juxtaposition of kind of looking so forward, and now you're kind of looking so backward, not backwards, that, you know, but
what
to
a nerdy
a different
thing to
period.
Do, right?
I know.
Two nerds in a club.
Like, how those two things kind of come together.
We got together a few years back, and in deference to our very wide-ranging musical tastes, did a double CD set called Shuffle, Play, Listen, which one disc of which was mostly classical or contemporary classical works by Janáček and Stravinsky and Piazzolla and Martinu. And I did some arrangements in homage to Bernard Herrmann, who would have been celebrating his 100th birthday. He was the film score composer to many of Alfred Hitchcock's films.
Yeah.
So we did a few movements of Vertigo, the soundtrack. And then the second CD was our arrangements of songs by Arcade Fire and Radiohead and A Perfect Circle and John McLaughlin. So we've played a lot of different repertoire. In a way, we're looking back, but in another way, we're just going to the source.
Yeah.
We're trying to get closer to the original voice that Beethoven would have known in his time.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, one example of the juxtaposition and the lesson of playing on these instruments, you listen to the Appassionata, the Opus 57 sonata of Beethoven, and it, you know, the Allegro begins with just double-fisted bass chords, mm-hmm. and it just sounds so unwieldy on the modern piano. And if you play it on a forte piano, you all of a sudden have this sense of the transparency that you just can't get on the modern piano. And so it's very instructive. And in that way, it's really quite revolutionary. Again, going back to the original voice becomes more of a radical statement than playing them, well, as we did in Eugene, Oregon, when there was no forte piano or regular piano available. I played it on my Casio Privia, you know, perfectly happily. The other nice thing is on the original instruments, they resound much more deeply and integrally. We tune our modern instruments to A at 440, that's vibrations per second.
Okay.
And other modern orchestras sometimes tune as high as 442, 444, 46 to the A. Hmm. These instruments sound best at 430. We discovered that when we arrived in Chicago, and the tuner had actually tuned my forte piano to 440, and it sounded strangled and really not very happy. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Matt's gut strings, you know, didn't really sound that great at 440. And so when we got that straight, you know, at 430, everything just opened up and breathed and resounded and et cetera. So playing them at the at Sam Bond's garage in Eugene and not having any keyboard, my Casio at the touch of a button can be tuned down to 430. So we were in absolute, you know, original tuning, but playing on this digital piano.
That's
and, you know,
very cool.
Going back to your question, I mean, Chris and I reach out to new audiences and young and old audiences, but that's not how we choose our repertoire. I mean, we follow our passions, and with the first project with Shuffle Play Listen, we didn't play Arcade Fire and Radiohead and John McLaughlin because we were hoping that audience would come to us. We played that music because we love it just
because
as much
awesome
as Janáček and Stravinsky.
Yeah, exactly.
And we want it fit on our program. And and you know, the latest thing that's on our mind is this Beethoven on period instruments, and so we weren't thinking, oh my God, this is really nerdy and nobody's, you know, we're gonna lose all of our Radiohead fans.
Right.
We were like, you know, this is what we got to do right now, and hopefully, you know, the audience will follow us as we, you know, experiences adventure.
Well, it's a very cool sound. I mean, I've been listening to the CD, and it is really neat. I mean, you can really hear the difference with the period instruments. And but I have one more burning question before you guys take off. Did you wear period clothing while recording the CD?
Just wigs.
The puffy shirt. the Seinfeld puffy shirt.
Yes.
No, I guess we didn't.
Oh, that's too bad.
Chris took his shoes off. Does that count?
Yes, I did take my shoes off.
Yes, that does count.
because we've got our... Well, here's the other anachronism. You know, we were both playing off of iPads.
Really?
And I had my foot switch to turn the pages, and then I had these very odd pedals, the soft pedal that we were in love with, and the other pedal, the damper pedal, you know, the one that makes things sort of wet and echoey on the piano, that was actually split in two. I could actually play with pedal on the upper end of the piano and not at the bottom, if I so chose. So, yeah, I really needed to have toe contact with these pedals to really just be able to tell them apart.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't let me take my shoes off. So
no,
I kept mine on.
He should really change his socks more often.
Oh, God. We've been on tour far too long.
Well, on that note, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. I really appreciate you guys coming on the show today. And actually, this has been great because we have been wanting to get both of you individually onto the show for ages. And now we got you both. This was fabulous.
Great opportunity and a really
kill
wonderful
two players time. With one.
That's
with
right.
One
don't sound. Kill the don't shoot the piano player.
I hope you come back with.
Yeah, this was great.
Either
fun.
Together or separately, either way is great.
Yes, anytime.
Thanks,
guys. All right, everybody, that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classical Classroom, just go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom or check out an exhaustive list, or exhausting list, whichever way you want to look at it, of our shows at soundcloud.com/classicalclassroom. You can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr, or you can email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Did you know that you can also listen to us on Stitcher and TuneIn apps for your mobile devices? True story. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Rundgren Holslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for his highly questionable taste in pop music. Thanks to Mark DiClaudio for his piercing gray eyes. Thanks to Christopher O'Reilly and Matt Heimovitz for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words. But of course, most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.